Next case, Miller v. St. Paul Mercury Insurance, Mr. Bradley.
May it please the court, my name is Ryan Bradley, and I represent the realigned plaintiffs in this matter. Though the facts of this case are somewhat convoluted and complicated, the issue is not. This is a very simple duty to defend case where St. Paul is trying to get out of that duty to defend by applying the insured versus insured exclusion.
By enforcing its contract, right? Insured versus insured. I don't know. Seems pretty straightforward to me.
That's correct, Your Honor. It is very straightforward. And in fact, the policy calls for coverage in this particular situation. The fact that two out of the three...
No, I don't understand that. That's an exclusion, insured versus insured.
It's two of the underlying plaintiffs are not insured, correct? The Kings.
It's our contention that actually three are.
Well, we'll
not
talk about the trust, but,
okay.
But at least the Kings are not insured. Everybody can agree on that.
That's
right?
Correct.
Okay. So if the Kings had filed a separate complaint on their own behalf, the D&O policy would have applied, correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
And it's in fact our assertion that in essence they did file a separate claim on their own behalf. The underlying claim in state court is not a class action, unlike Sphinx and Power Sports, which are cited by St. Paul. There is no representative capacity in any of the claims in the underlying action. They were simply all filed together for judicial economy, rather than having five separate cases stating almost identical facts. All the cases were put together with common allegations, and separate claims for relief were requested. Furthermore, in the policy that St. Paul did draft, they define claim in a number of ways. Certainly, the district court gave note to the definition of claim, which was in reference to a civil proceeding. However, there was a second definition as well that referenced a demand for money damages. So certainly in a policy which is drafted by the insurer, when we're talking about an insurance exclusion,
it wouldn't make any sense really to interpret this policy in such a way as to make coverage depend upon whether five plaintiffs filed five complaints or one or three, would it?
No, and that's exactly the point. The fact of the matter is, in Level 3, this court has devised a way to deal with this exact type of situation.
No, that's not the exact same. See, that was a very special case where the insured was added later, and that's not like this case.
The guidance that can be garnered from Level 3, however...
But if you look at the way Level 3 is written and the way other courts have interpreted Level 3, it's a very special situation. It's not meant to undermine the insured versus insured exclusion, which is obviously very sensible from the insurance company's perspective.
The insured versus insured exclusion is not being modified or abrogated in any way here. The fact it becomes that three...
You have insureds on the plaintiff's side.
But that does not...
From the get-go.
That does not...
What's left of the insured versus insured exclusion? Do you only recognize it when every plaintiff is when do you only recognize the exclusion when all the plaintiffs are insureds, and if the one isn't, then it's all out the window? Is that the idea? Is that your position?
That's not our position. Our position is, in fact, that the duty to defend is totally separate from the duty to indemnify. And the duty...
No, there's an allocation provision under duty to defend in the policy. The insurance company can it just advance the defense cost proportionate to the number to the part of the suit for which there's coverage, right? It's very explicit about that.
And in this particular case, there was no coverage for any of the claims.
Well, there was a complete refusal. But would you object to a holding that, as Judge Posner just suggested, namely, there's a duty to cover a proportion of the defense costs?
We would, and that's because the duty to defend covers the entire action, while the indemnity goes to the allocation clause.
No. It's not just indemnity. It's defense costs are subject to the allocation.
In this case, though, the St. Paul has not advanced any of the costs. It was a total denial.
So is there any objection to just saying, I thought your position was simply that St. Paul's blanket rejection of covering even the King's claim is a breach of the contract, and that you're entitled to a fair allocation of both defense costs and any ultimate indemnity?
That's correct.
No, you're not arguing that. You want all the defense costs. Maybe I missed it, but I didn't think you were arguing for an allocation of defense costs.
The duty to defend...
I miss something? Are you arguing for it? Are you arguing for an allocation of defense costs as an alternative to getting them all?
No, we're not. No. We're arguing for the entirety of defense costs.
Wait a minute.
It's all or nothing, right?
You just told me you wanted an allocation. I'm very confused.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. The allocation would apply to any indemnity that would be reached in the underlying action down the road. However, it's at a standstill now because St. Paul has rejected all.
Right. Well, okay. Let's look at the. Can you direct me to the allocation provision? And whether it applies to the duty to defend.
The allocation provision is on page. I'm referring actually to St. Paul's appendix 68, supplemental appendix A. Notably, under the initial duty of the insurer to defend, the insurer's duty to defend claims shall apply, even if any of the allegations are groundless, false, or fraudulent.
It doesn't have to advance all the costs of the defense, right? Oh, I'm missing something.
The allocation clause does state that, Your Honor.
But your position is, but that's not what, you're not arguing for the allocation in the alternative. It's all or nothing is your position. In your brief, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. Our position is that in this particular case, St. Paul left the plaintiffs in the declaratory judgment case in essentially high and dry with no allocation whatsoever to defense costs or to potential.
But you didn't want an allocation. You didn't want any defense costs except everything. And they said, no, you can't have all the defense costs, which is true. It's what the policy says.
Under your theory, if there are 100 plaintiffs, 99 of them are insured, and one is not insured, 100% of the defense costs have to be covered. Is that right?
That's not the argument that I would like to advance.
That's what you just told Judge Posner.
In this case,
you just said it's all or nothing.
That's what St. Paul's argument is, and that's what the district court found, that the presence of these two insured defendants killed the whole action. In fact, in the conclusion of the brief,
that's a different issue. The question is. isn't it true that you believe that the insurance company had to pick up all the defense costs?
No, I'm sorry, Your Honor. I misunderstood.
That's the position in your brief.
In the brief, actually, in the conclusion, we asked that the court reverse the decision of the district court and hold that the claims of Gene King, Teresa King, and the Glendale Lane Trust are not barred by the insured versus insured provision.
No, we know that. This is about the defense costs. And in your conclusion, you say that you don't ask for allocation.
Because the particular issue appealed from the court below in this case is whether or not the presence of insured parties, in essence, destroys the defense and indemnification for all of the parties.
No, but you seem to have, and you admitted a few minutes ago, that so far as defense costs, as distinct from indemnity, you believe that as long as there's the presence of a non-insured, the insurance company has to pick up all the defense costs.
I misspoke, Your Honor. If that's what I said a few minutes ago, it's clear from our brief and from the allocation clause in the insurance contract.
No, it's not clear from your brief. There's nothing in that.
So you would agree that the allocation clause and its reference to loss would include defense costs?
Yes.
Okay.
And that's
Can we talk about Ms. Lane and her trust for a second?
Sure.
Is to the extent anybody's going to argue for a majority rule, I don't know. I guess we would need to resolve that. But Ms. Lane, she is uninsured, correct?
Ms. Lane individually is an insured as
okay.
a director of
the Is bank. She a beneficiary of the Glendale L. Lane Trust?
I believe she would be.
Okay. And the exclusion applies to a claim brought or maintained by or on behalf of any insured in any capacity. So why isn't a claim on behalf that is made by her trust, of which she's a beneficiary, a covered claim?
It's because before the definition of the covered claim, before we get there, we have to look to what an insured person is defined as under the policy. In that particular situation, the only definition of an insured would be a director or an officer.
And that's Ms. Lane.
Correct. As
so
an
she's
individual.
A beneficiary. But she's a beneficiary of the plaintiff, so this is a claim being maintained on her behalf by her trust, right?
It's being maintained. But she, in order for the insured versus insured exclusion to apply, it has to be an insured person.
What is the force of that in any capacity? What does that mean?
You've just eliminated it.
Well, I didn't draft the contract.
What
does
it mean? What does it mean?
The in any capacity mm-hmm. language? It would mean, for instance,
mention a trustee as an example of capacity? Isn't that given as an example of a capacity in which a insured might be operating?
It is, but in the facts of this case,
so any capacity includes a trustee. That's explicit. You read that out of the insurance policy.
But also in the insurance policy, a director or officer, which is what the individual Mrs. Lane is defined as a natural person.
Right. And as a natural person, she's a beneficiary of the plaintiff, trust, right?
Correct. But the trust is not a natural person. The trust is not a director or officer.
So what meaning does in any capacity have then? What work do those words do? If not to prevent evasion of the insured versus insured exclusion by this sort of indirect assignment or delegation of the claim.
I do not know what the terms in any capacity would mean in that regard. We were not the party drafting the policy.
Well,
it's unclear.
Let me put it to you that that's a pretty obvious reading of it, and I haven't heard anything that rebuts that. So, okay.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Bradley. Mr. Leffler?
Thank you. Morning. May it please the Court. I'm Michael Loeffler, and I represent St. Paul Mercury Insurance Company in this matter. I guess I want to start, Your Honors, by saying that the language of the insured versus insured exclusion and related provisions in the policy of insurance at issue here are clear and unambiguous, and therefore, under Illinois law, must be applied as written.
Well, that's a bold position. Let me ask you, Mr. Loeffler, flip the hypothetical. 100 plaintiffs, 99 of them are not insured, one is. Your position is no duty to indemnify or defend any of the claim.
That would depend, Your Honor, and I'm not trying to be equivocal, but this policy, unlike the one that this Court reviewed in Level 3, specifically takes into account and considers the concerns that the Level 3 Court had and added seven exceptions to the insured versus insured exclusion. So my answer to your question, Judge Hamilton, would depend on what type of lawsuit was it.
Suppose it's this one.
Mm-hmm. In this one? In this one, my position would be that the claim would be precluded.
One, in essence, one insured plaintiff taints the whole action.
What if
there are 100 complaints filed, one on behalf of the insured claimant, 99 on behalf of uninsured claimants? Do you have a duty to defend and indemnify on those 99?
You're talking about complaints that basically are alleging the same causes of action,
yep.
Your Honor?
Mm-hmm.
I would say no.
Why
I would
not?
Say
How do you say that?
Because the practical effect would be that those cases would almost certainly be consolidated or be determined to be interrelated. And if they were interrelated, then we would still
so
look to the
policy's definition of claim applies to anything, any related or parallel actions. Is that right?
Well, the policy's definition of claim encompasses a number of types of ways.
But it's a clear definition, right?
It is a clear definition, yes.
Extreme. Suppose in Judge Hamilton's case, 100 complaints are filed by 100 separate people in all 100 federal districts. And then suppose the panel on multi-district litigation, sua sponte, consolidates them in one district for pretrial. Would that act of consolidation, which was involuntary on the part of the plaintiffs, dissolve the claims of the 99?
Again, Your Honor, we would look to the policy language to determine whether...
Answer yes or no?
My answer is probably yes.
Well,
it would depend on whether any of the exceptions would apply and whether there was active participation by the insured in that lawsuit.
Where does that active participation concept come from? Is that in the exceptions?
It's in the exceptions.
Where can you direct me to it?
In the exclusion section of the policy, Your Honor, which unfortunately...
You're saying these your way of responding to the concerns in Level 3 is not proportionality of insured versus non-insured, but it's some this set of exceptions, one of which is that the insured is not an actively involved in litigation. Is that
correct? For example, Your Honor, exception A to the insured versus insured exclusion is for a claim that is a derivative action brought or maintained on behalf of the company by one or more persons who are not directors or officers, and to bring and maintain such claim without the solicitation, assistance, or active participation of any director or officer. So in the scenario you posed, Your Honor, it would depend on whether they were receiving active participation or solicitation from a director or officer.
But that's not the position you've taken here.
The position we've taken here, Your Honor, is that from the get-go, like the like Sphinx and Power Sports, the claim was precluded from filing. This claim involves five plaintiffs, three of whom are insureds and whose damages comprise 81% of the claim damages.
So, but why doesn't the allocation provision deal with this problem? What do you say to the Kings? You should have just filed a separate complaint, right?
No, I still don't think that would make any difference, Your Honor. And as Magistrate Bernthal and Chief Judge McCuskey found in the district court, the exclusion for the IVI exclusion is in the section entitled Exclusions Applicable to All Insuring Agreements and All Loss. The allocation provision, Your Honor, does not create a grant of coverage. And to skip over an exclusion that would bar the entire claim and create a grant of coverage could lead to the evisceration of the insured versus insured exclusion. It could also lead to unintended consequences, such as lawsuits being filed by non-insureds and bringing in insureds later on, simply to try to avoid the application of the IVI.
Why would that be a bad thing if you all agreed to cover claims brought by people who are not insured?
Well, we didn't agree to cover claims brought by insureds, and the insured versus insured exclusion as drafted in this policy, unlike the one in the Level 3 case, was designed to provide exceptions for those circumstances, certain circumstances, where there were a mix of insureds and non-insureds. Those provisions are clear and are entitled to be applied as written. Similarly, I think we could look to the Sphinx case for guidance on that, where a similar exclusion that read the coverage would be precluded for claims by or at the behest of any director or officer or by any security holder of the company, whether directly or derivatively, unless such claim is instigated and continued totally independent of and totally without the solicitation of or assistance of or active participation of or intervention of any director or officer of the company or any affiliate of the company.
Okay, but I guess I'm stuck on the Kings. Okay?
Okay.
Let's suppose they've got a legitimate claim against your insured, Strategic Capital. And they're not, their claim would not be covered by any of these exceptions, would it?
By any of which exceptions?
The exceptions to the exclusion.
No, it would not.
Okay. So coverage and indemnification, as a practical matter, their ability to recover would depend upon whether they went to the same lawyer, whether they talked to anybody who was insured, whether the state court decided to consolidate their complaint with some others. So it's basically totally out of their hands, right?
Well, again, their claim does not fall within any of the exceptions. They chose to go to the same lawyer and file one lawsuit.
Well, suppose they go to a different lawyer. I mean, do you really want the policy to be interpreted in such a way that is the incentive that creates? That
no, Your Honor. Created? And we would submit that that's not how it should be applied. We would submit that, again, we would look to the practical effect of those claims would likely be consolidated or deemed interrelated under the terms of the policy, and therefore the exclusion would apply.
So they're just left out.
Given the scenario,
even though they're not insured, they go to a separate lawyer, they have no control over what the courts do or what the insured plaintiffs might do, they're just stuck.
I would submit, Your Honor, that that's the case, and that's consistent with both the Sphinx and Power Sports cases, which applied and extended the logic and reasoning of the Level 3 case.
Well, that's an interesting interpretation of them. So, okay.
Well, and again, Your Honor, in Sphinx, the former officer and director of Sphinx, Taylor, filed a securities class action complaint. He published notice of the lawsuit over National Newswire Services and then amended his complaint to add his plaintiff's shareholders that responded to his solicitation. Sphinx requested coverage for the action under its insurance policy issued by Genesis. And Genesis denied based on the insured versus insured exclusion that is very similar to the one we have at issue today. The 11th Circuit affirmed on appeal the grant of summary judgment applying the insured versus insured exclusion. It held that, or distinguished Level 3 as being, quote, too different to be useful, in that the facts were different and the policy exclusion at issue was different. And the important difference that it found was that the former director plaintiff was merely a passive shareholder in Level 3 who joined a larger suit, which was not the case in Sphinx, and it's not the case in our present case. Therefore, you know, I would indicate to the court that the exceptions are designed to carve out or meet those concerns that were expressed by this court in Level 3 and should be applied as written. The is reflected by the exceptions to the exclusion. The critical factor is whether the underlying action is brought or maintained without the solicitation, assistance, or active participation of an insured.
Can we look at that, I guess, a little more carefully here? Are you looking at 4B, the exclusion there?
I can. I have 4B.
Okay. See if I'm reading this correctly. Excluded from the exclusion here is a claim brought or maintained by a natural person who was a director or officer, but who has not served as a director or officer for at least 6 years preceding the date the claim is first made. That's the first element, right?
Correct.
So that's somebody who is insured, right?
Yes.
Okay. So what this tells us, this is a category of people who are insured who can bring claims if they also meet the, and they're covered, if they meet the additional requirement of doing this without solicitation, assistance, or active participation, et cetera, of folks who've done this within the last 6 years.
Well, the caveat,
but that doesn't apply to people who were not ever insured.
No, but, Your Honor, I think the proper reading of that exception is that if a lawsuit is brought by both insureds and non-insureds, but the insureds have not been
that.
A director officer for at least 6 years.
How do you get that out of this? Because this doesn't apply at all if the plaintiff was never insured.
No, Your Honor. If the exception B applies when the claim is brought by a director who has not been an insured for at least a director for 6 years.
Right. But that person still qualifies as insured.
Well, they are by definition an insured.
Right.
Correct.
So this tells us nothing, then, about claims brought by somebody who was never an insured, like the Kings.
No, because if this exception applies where there is a mix of insured and non-insureds.
No, it doesn't.
It does, Your Honor, in this sense. If that insured is carved out by this exception because he or she has not been a director for 6 years prior, then the exclusion would not apply. But if there is an insured and a non-insured in the same lawsuit and the insured has been a director or officer within that past 6 years, the exclusion would still apply.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Blackmore. Mr. Bradley, anything further?
I'm very, very short on time.
Expired, but you can have a minute. So.
Thank you. In summary, I would just like to point out that the Kings were never insureds, and they cannot be squeezed into an exception to the insured versus insured exclusion if they were never insureds to begin with. And that's, in essence, what St. Paul is arguing in a moment ago. Furthermore, despite the misunderstandings in my initial argument, the allocation clause would apply in this particular situation, and this all falls to the definition of claim. If there was one flaw in this case, it was that these cases were for judicial economy filed together. I think it's clear that if they were filed separately, the King's cases and arguably the Glendale Lane Trust would have survived. The insured versus insured exclusion cannot apply to the Kings, and therefore any loss, including duty to defend or indemnification, should be allocated. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Bradley. Thank you, Mr. Leffler. Next.